a great pleasure to have the privilege of talking to Aidan Southall, a very distinguished anthropologist and teacher of many anthropologists. Aidan, you were born in 1920.
Yes.
Where were you born?
A place called Nuneaton in Warwickshire.
And can you tell us something about your parents and your family?
My father was an Anglican parson, vicar of the parish. Died of cancer at a fairly early age. I think he was 56, perhaps, not so early in those days, but my mother, who was a wonderful saint and had the usual life of a rural parson's wife, of trying to keep up with everything, run the house and entertain people and know the village, go to church, of course, and get worn out by it.
Did either of your parents particularly influence you by either their beliefs or their ideas or their examples, would you say?
Yes, they both did by the example of their lives. Not in any didactic way. But yes, it was an influence which grew much greater after they had gone, as I reflected on them and myself. And I mean, they were both of very much one mind themselves. And I was sorry that I'd lost the chance of associating with them in a more purposeful way than I did before they were gone. Actually, I mean, as far as my father was concerned, he had practically no salary as a parson. He never had a car, and he used to go around on a bicycle. And he would take me occasionally, so those are occasions that I remember. And when my mother got into the nursing home, she lasted for quite a long while, perhaps 20 years then, and was really, it was a happy thing, as it so rarely is. And although I was to and fro between here and Africa and various places, I did manage to go and visit her there fairly, not regularly, but fairly frequently. And she was always writing to me.
Did it influence your religious beliefs? So you were Christian, for instance,
Yes, I always was, and although there may have been periods of relative revolt, I never entirely rejected it, and so it was in both their cases.
Where did you go to school? Where were your schools?
Well, we were in this rural vicarage, Dullingham, near Newmarket. And my mother had an old friend, very old friend, who was a school teacher in the old days, I'm sure primary school teacher, and they're a very dear friend. She asked her to come and help start me off, which she did. I don't know exactly what she did. It can't have been entirely informal, yet it wasn't very formal, and I imagine it was with her that I learnt to write and read.
And then you went on to a secondary school at...
I went, we were just 12 miles from Cambridge and on the railway, which worked, you know, reasonably well in those days. And so I was sent on the train to Cambridge to attend the Perse prep school, preparatory school, which went on from perhaps 3 years. And then in the Perse Boys School for the rest of my school education.
What subjects did you particularly specialise or enjoy at school?
Well, there was virtually no specialisation. Of course, then we came to higher certificate, school certificate, and I do remember, and I much regret it, though I don't know whether I could have done otherwise, I fairly soon began to feel that I was a poor mathematician, never learned calculus, and decided that I'd better make a huge effort to do well in the school certificate exam and get a credit. And I managed to do that. And I never did any more mathematics, which I've been very sorry for.
Were there any teachers in particular at that school who influenced you or you were stimulated by? I mean, you don't have to remember the names, but...
Oh, I probably will, but... well, I suppose... just come into my mind while you dig around in these things. The one I really ought to mention, who never did teach me, but was famous as having been, he had been headmaster, I think, but he was more famous as a classical teacher, W.H.D. Rouse. He was one of those, probably quite many now, who translated Homer. And he bought a house, or he had a house. I never knew him as a teacher at the Perse School, but only after his retirement. I was never on very good terms with the headmaster. At least, I mean, a small fry, I didn't have any relationship with him of any kind, so I was neither on good or bad terms. But when I, you know, made prefect and that sort of thing, I was beginning to have to do things. I occasionally had disputes with him, which in the end caused me to... I became... There were four schoolhouses, and I sort of inevitably, by attrition, became the head of one of these schoolhouses. They were geographical, north, south, east and west. And... I wasn't a great athlete. I played rugby, football. I was a poor cricketer. I played fives, and I was made captain of fives. We didn't have any great team which could have performed. It wasn't sufficiently popular or well enough established. But, I can remember there was a famous family at... was it Clare? The Redaways, did you ever know any of them?
Yes, there were Marxists, I think, some of them, and historians and economists.
Historians, certainly. Yes, and Brian was a famous historian. I forget what that. I'm not sure it wasn't the Great Fire.
Yes, something.
And the old man, he had also been a historian, but I think he was retired. He was a very delightful and genial old character. They used to sort of... there were several, it was a typical Cambridge thing, I think. They'd say, would you like to come along and weed the garden? And we often said yes, but perhaps more... well, not more important, but more interesting. They had collected their old sets of carols from King's...
Don't worry. Just drop it. That's fine.
And because we were living after my father died, my mother was determined that I should come to Cambridge, and there were various people connected with the Diocese of Ely who wanted to help her, and some others. For example, she and I used to walk to church every Sunday at Holy Trinity, and there was a fairly distinguished parson there called Max Warren. I mean, he later became better known because he was made General Secretary of the Church Missionary Society, which was very important to a certain type of Anglican. And then he was made a Canon of Westminster, and so he became quite eminent in that way. But the point was that I knew him because we were members of the congregation, and he, knowing my mother's deep concerns and wanting to help her after she was left a widow, was extremely kind to me. You know, at a certain time you get asked to submit testimonials. I can't think what for, but he was one of those I asked. And as it happened, he had been at Jesus College, and he told me about that. And Jesus had a lot of money for parsons' children, sons. Rustat was the benefactor who left the fund. It must have been a lot of money. And I was eventually a Rustat. You know, I only scraped an exhibition at first, and then I got a first, they gave me a scholarship, so I got through that way.
What subject did you do?
I'd been, you asked me about specialising, and I said I didn't. But when we began doing the school certificate, I foolishly got rid of mathematics, arithmetic. And then higher certificate, I was still doing classical subjects. So the Greek and Latin and ancient history. And I did take a certain liking for ancient history. It was sweat to swat it all up, mountains of detail, but I managed that over several hurdles. And then later when people asked me, well, why did you switch from classics? And I said, well, I wasn't good enough for writing Greek verse. And incidentally, in my anthropological career, the beginnings of it were not all that promising, that I didn't really have the best people, although perhaps they were very good people. At first, my supervisor was Jack Dryburgh.
Oh, yes.
Who was a famous character.
Yes.
Who collected stories around himself about starting tribal wars, which are certainly apocryphal, but having spear contests, and perhaps he did do that, though I never saw him doing it. Anyway, he had one of those huge houses on by the Catholic Church, on that near over by the little river there. That one respected him because one knew he had been a real anthropologist. In fact, he published quite a lot, because he not only did his first book on the Lango whom he had studied, and that was one of the classical ethnographies. But he wrote a number of smaller books, many of which tended towards interesting young people in the subject. People of the Small Arrow.
Yes, I know that.
One or two more like that.
Was he a bad or a good teacher, or just a chaotic teacher?
I think he was quite a good teacher, and more or less gave lectures that one could follow. I wouldn't put it above that. I don't think he was brilliant. But otherwise, you see, we had J.H. Hutton, who was the professor,
yes,
who used to boom at you in class,
yes,
and cause laughter, inadvertently or otherwise, and of course wrote his book about the seminagas.
Yes.
But otherwise didn't convey the idea of any real distinction.
What year was this that you came up with?
This was perhaps 1935. Mm. Not coming up, no, coming up was 39.
Yeah. But these people were lecturing you in 39, were they?
Yes.
Mm. So Hutton was booming.
Dreiberg was...
Yes.
Giving reasonably competent lectures and reasonably systematic.
Yes.
And the physical anthropologist was quite good. I've forgotten his name.
Was it Jack Trevor? Or
yes, it was.
Mm. Yeah. So you're doing the Arcananth tripos, really? Mm. You did the whole tripos from the first year. What did you change in the middle?
After the tripos, the two-year tripos, I was a conscientious objector.
Mm.
And when I went to my tribunal, I said, you know, that I was perfectly happy to do heavy rescue or something like that, but there wasn't any because the Blitz was over and there was a lull and no spectacular things were going on. So when I said I were, you know, I didn't mind going into the, couldn't go into the Friends Ambulance because it's always full up and oversubscribed. I wouldn't mind going to anything medical. And somehow in the end they seemed to, I suppose they saw that I wasn't strictly speaking a malingerer and that I was quite serious about what I was doing. They more or less let me go on what I was doing.
Really?
Well, they told me to go and get a sort of public service job in London. Mm. And that was pretty funny because I went there and I didn't know who to consult. But through some coincidence, because I didn't know her before, I fell into the hands of Mary Trevelyan.
Mm.
Do you ever hear of her?
One of the famous Trevelyan family, no doubt.
She was, but she was the one who started a place which was also very well known in Stead. It was called Student Movement House.
Mm.
And it catered for overseas students. Had a house in Gower Street as a club. And she was almost a concert pianist and very, very musical and good at running club activities. But she had a staff of two or three, they were called sub-wardens. And so she took me on as one of those, and that counted for my war service.
Did you encounter at that student house foreign students?
Oh, yes, yes.
Did that play any part in your move towards Africa or not?
It may very well have done, but I think I usually, when asked such a question, the first thing I mention is that in my last year at the Perse, when I knew I'd done the scholarship exam several times and wasn't going to get in a more brilliant result than I had, the old man, whose daughter was at the Perse Girls' School and was a great friend of my sister, and he was minister of the Congregational Church, Emmanuel, just by Peterhouse. And he went to my mother and said, I want you to let Aidan come with me to the West Indies, to Jamaica, during the long vacation, during the summer. because his son was teaching in a well-regarded secondary school in Jamaica, and this boy Peter Carter had some troubles. He'd sort of tried to be a missionary in what's now Malawi, and for one reason or another, you know, it turned out not to be very successful. He'd given that up and become a school teacher, and that was all right. But his father was always very much concerned about him. So off we went on a banana boat. And that was my first footstep outside England. So it obviously had a great effect. And by that time, I'd got some sort of entrance to Cambridge and Jesus. I may have had an exhibition. And I'd been put in touch with Jayberg, who became my supervisor, but at this point was just given to me as an advisor by the Jesus College people, or by the anthropology department, I'm not sure which. And what came next? Well, of course, so Jayberg suggested that I should, if we were going to Jamaica, I should take with me The Mind of Primitive Man. The Mind of Primitive Man was Boas, perhaps the most famous of the anthropologists of the day, I mean, little the previous generation.
Who were your contemporaries when you were an undergraduate? Were there any other anthropologists there that went on to do anthropology?
Pretty few. There was one chap who was exactly coeval, and we were friends, but he was from a different college, Queens, I think, and so we hadn't long been friends, and didn't rather know one another terribly well, and I don't know what became of him. The other one was Kenneth Little.
Oh, yes.
Who was a year or two older than me and got going very wisely and got quite good jobs, actually.
So, taking us to the end of the war and the end of your time as a sub-warden, what happened then?
Well, the other thing was that, of course, Cambridge, London School of Economics was evacuated to Cambridge, or the whole of London, much of London University, I don't know what, but certainly LSE. And it, I think I had the minor initiative to write perhaps to the Royal African Society and say, had they got any books that I could review for them? And they sent me a few, and I reviewed them. And then the reviews were published, and they were seen by Audrey Richards and Raymond Firth. And Audrey, among her many charming traits, was very careless with her file, so that you're liable to find yourself reading a letter about yourself. So I knew that they'd taken quite a positive view of these first efforts of mine at reviewing a book, or two books. I reviewed Black Byzantium,
yes,
and certainly one other which I can't remember. And so out of that, I got to know Audrey when she was at Cambridge, and Firth, but Firth sort of directed me to Audrey because she'd been in East Africa. Well, so had he. No, she had been much more in East Africa. And was willing to take me on also, so I became very close to her during that time, and she really sort of took on responsibility for finding something effective for me to do. And
what was she like as a person?
Charming, charming. Witty, humanistic, literary family.
Yes. Buffers.
So
she found you something to do. You were wanting to do a PhD, were you, or what?
I hadn't thought a word about that level, that stage. I wanted to get a job. I had to get a job. And by that time I realized it sounded as though it would probably be somewhere out of Britain, or let's say Africa by this time probably was becoming clear. And Audrey said, look here, there's Makerere on a hill outside Kampala, and it's going to be developed into a university college, and they want somebody to teach social studies. And so I said, yes, I was interested. And so then the Crown agents for the colonies in those days were dealing with such types of appointments, sending me the papers and getting the records set up. But I was offered that job to teach social studies, and of course that meant going out to Uganda. And although the war had ended a few months before, there was no transport. It was all officially allocated and hard to get onto or into. But eventually a passage was found for me, and I think I had to go to Poole or somewhere to get on a plane. It was all sort of ad hoc. The plane took me to one of those airfields in North Africa. You know, there was a whole string that the Eighth Army went from one to another and then back again. And I got on that plane. I remember we landed first in the south of France. I have no idea where. I wish I knew where it had been. And then it was North Africa, Tobruk, and little hops, and then eventually reaching Cairo, which wasn't the end, of course, because we were far from Uganda and Makerere. But of course there were lots of people passing through Cairo in those days, there always are. I was in this hotel, which was a real luxury hotel in what's that sort of suburban city outside Cairo? Doesn't matter. Only a few miles away.
Khartoum? No,
not as far as that. It was like 10 miles from Cairo, and more of a resort town, really. So I was there, and I was told that a plane would be found to take me to Uganda, which turned out to be that service which they had of flying boats going down the Nile, 200 miles at a time. So it took quite a while. Meanwhile, entertain yourself. So I go out in the streets of Cairo and begin to, you know, consume any exotic fruit I see being sold there. And I was aware that a lot of people around me were talking about Jippy Tummy all the time. But through some miracle, I never got it on that occasion. And after about 4 days of enjoying myself in Cairo and going to the pyramids and so forth, and the museum, the flying boat was ready, and I flew to this time to, last landing was on Lake Victoria. And I started off at McHenry.
Can you describe what McHenry was like when your first impressions?
Well, it already had quite an impressive sort of central building with a tower, a bit like the library on a small scale. And I discovered that the job that I'd been given was quite small beer, really. And I was told, but first, when I arrived there, I was put up in his garden guest house by the then principal, who was a man called, I'm not going to remember, doesn't matter. He'd been a famous headmaster of Charterhouse and Marlborough. Oh, Turner was his name, George Turner. Very, very nice man and very cultured. Classical scholar, of course. And so I was living in his house. Yes, I was living in his house. Well, then he had this rest house with a bedroom and bathroom and so forth, just down the grass slope in the garden. And so I was put in there, but I went up to his house for meals. So it was rather close. And he had the practice, which was pretty unusual for colonials at the time, to go out for a country walk every evening. You know, I mean, you picture the elephant grass and the bush going out for a country walk. And so, knowing my interests, I went with him, and I picture him, you know, sweating up hillsides. Because Kampala, of course, is one of those places supposedly built on seven hills, and geologists described it as a peony plain, I think, which meant that it had rather sort of like flat top copies sticking up all round, and McKellar is just on one of these. So we went round having a very nice time, and it was very educational for me because he was a very highly cultured man. And eventually more people began to come out filling up jobs that were vacant at McHenry, and so they had to get houses built, and I moved into one of the houses, and so it went on.
What were you teaching?
Well, Turner told me to go and see Batten, who was the vice principal, and he was a man who'd come out. He'd had some experience in Nigeria. He was quite an interesting man, and he'd written some small books which were very, very useful, but not really at a scholarly level, not meant to be. And so he just told me, I think he probably told me to lecture from Lord Halley's African Survey, which had just come out, which of course was a remarkable book when it came out, but was neither literary, it wasn't exactly literary, though it was very well done. It was pretty dull to work with. So I didn't really follow that. And I haven't described who the students were, and I better cut it down short. There were just 200 students at that time. And they were all special people chosen from the secondary schools all over East Africa. You'd think there would be more than 200, but there weren't for that level. So we had, of course, from Uganda, Kenya, Tanganyika, as it was then, and Zanzibar, and even some from then northern Rhodesia. So it was absolutely international. And yet, nothing but 200 poorly qualified students. But anyway, they did 2 years' work, which put them immensely forward from what they'd been, And so it began to build up its standards. And then after a few years, London University developed its scheme of association of budding universities, and eventually Macquarie qualified for this. So although it had no degree to give of its own, it was as it were licensed to give London degrees until it became a university as it is now, and the universities have proliferated like a rabbit burrow now there, because every religious sect, every strongly organized interest had to have its own university, and there was no power really at the time which was able to stop the process. We anthropologists were always agonizing over what anthropology really was, you know, as confused as outsiders were. And so, you know, with a cluster gathered around LSE and such places, we were constantly debating. And of course never reaching any very definitive conclusion, but that was the background of being an anthropologist. And it was only a few years ago when I was thinking about it and wondering if I should join the fray and write yet another book on the subject. I was very impressed, of course, the famous people otherwise in anthropology were Malinowski, Bronislaw Malinowski, Pole, whom I never really knew, but it was his...
Did you meet him?
Yes.
What impression did you get just from meeting him?
Not enough really to know, not at this point. But of course he had E.P. and all those people in his seminar. Yeah. But by the time I arrived, he was gone.
Who influenced you most, you think, at the theoretical level? You seem to have been quite strongly influenced by sociologists as well, to look at your writings.
Oh, well, we were inevitably, not because we wanted to be, but because sociology, from Kant onwards, presented us with something which was coherently organized and systematized. More than that, it was Audrey's fault. Audrey was in very close touch with the Uganda government. She was a very close friend of Sir Andrew Cohen, the governor, who was a very exceptional man. And so she was always thinking up ideas and always having demands from various people in the Uganda government, saying, because she was beginning the Institute of Social Research, though.
Sorry.
Have I left it all right?
Yes. Yeah.
She had started the East African Institute of Social Research by this time, and very soon gave me a job in it. But that was after I had done a spell at Macquarie doing this social studies thing. Because I had these people who were from all parts of East and some extent Central Africa, and they were naive about their own background, and it was recognized that this is one of the most important problems to deal with, which of course anthropology in its way would do, but there was never any question of that becoming a primary subject. So in my ad hoc courses, I rushed around reading up, you know, the intelligent person's background on East Africa, a good deal of history, but trying to incorporate social phenomena at the same time. Well, that was what I was doing. And to come to the end of it, perhaps, the problem never went away, of course. It went on throughout my decades of teaching.
The problem being that...
What is anthropology?
Yes.
and helped in a way but hindered in another by the fact that when people are asked what is anthropology, you were a bit tongue-tied, and the most satisfactory basis that anthropology had was this initiation through fieldwork. You know, being very generously given often 2 years off to begin with, which was thought absurd by most other disciplines. And so the fieldwork thing was very, very important. But as time went on, anthropologists began to write more sophisticated books about the subject and began to reflect on the theoretical framework of anthropology and the significance of fieldwork in it. And they began to feel, naturally enough, that, you know, fieldwork isn't enough, it's too naive, it's not really theoretical. It's hard to make fieldwork theoretical in the normal sense of academic theory. So it was still left hanging in a rather awkward situation. And as I went on thinking about it, I still felt that the field work background and initiation was absolutely vital and indeed original and unique and a serious contribution to the academy. And while I was thinking of this, some experiences of my fieldwork came to me, and especially the one, the sort of paradigmatic experience that hit me when I first went into the field, you know, went out beyond where anybody else was, greeting the chief, of course, asking permission to put my tent up there, whatever it was, and starting off whatever I was going to start off with. And in fact, I did have a tent. I did put it up, and I was for a while living in it. And while this was going on, I was, of course, very much in the village. And when it came to the opening of the agricultural year, and I saw this huge crowd of people milling around in the trees there, they'd been there all the afternoon. And young men would run up to the tent, calling out, because people knew that I was trying to learn the language. I hadn't got very far with it.
Where was this?
Well, this was in the West Nile district of Uganda, the far northwest.
Yeah.
Calling, hey, are you coming to dig with us? And I say, well, yes, but I haven't got a hoe. And that was quickly remedied, and I was given a hoe. So I began hoeing, knowing that if I didn't look out, I'd have enormous blisters very quickly. So doing it as carefully as I could. So there I was hoeing. And the system of cultivation, especially early in the year when you were getting fields cultivated ready for sowing and so forth, was that within a village or kin group, each homestead would call its neighbours to cultivate its field or fields on a very small scale, one after the other. First this chap here, then that chap there. So this is what I'd been involved in. But when they do that, each time that somebody invites his neighbours to that operation, he also has put on a drum of water to heat, and they have dug up the maize, which was always, you know, rough ground, and then buried in the earth for a month or so to mature, and then it could, further process could turn it into maize beer. So by the time the digging had finished, when everybody was hot and sweaty and tired, the beer was meant to be ready. And you retreated to the homestead, gathered round under the huts and the granaries, and everybody had either had or collected from the neighbourhood a sufficient number of calabashes for the number of people at den. Often could be 30 or so. And the beer was dished out. They had the strong beer was in a small pot. They'd ladle a small amount of that, and then hot water, or, you know, getting fairly near boiling. That was the way they liked it. So there I was, sitting there, seeing how I liked maize beer, and whether I was going to be able to drink it with pleasure. And, of course, everybody talking round and asking me questions, and me not being able to answer because I didn't know the language. So this is, you know, tremendous forced learning experience. And then after that had been going on, people had been drinking a bit, getting merry, and then one thing would be somebody would start to dance. And soon everybody was dancing. And the step was very easy to learn, you might say rather crude. But anyhow, and men would ask women to dance, or women would ask men to dance by seizing their hand and raising it up in the air. So while I was sitting there drinking, a woman comes, raises my hand, and I have to begin dancing. So you can see how one thing leads on to another. And probably it was 30 years after, when I was thinking about this business of how you introduce anthropology, I thought, well, there are three fundamental paradigmatic experiences which can be squeezed down to the three D's. Dig, drink, dance. And that's how I'd write an introductory textbook anthropology if I was to do one.
Did you enjoy field work?
Yes. I mean,
you've worked in many places. Where you worked in Madagascar, in
yes.
Uganda. You've done a lot of field work, haven't you?
Yes, but the big ones were that northwest Uganda, which sort of remained with me up till now, except it's hard to get there now because of the various fightings. And then Madagascar, as you said. But the other thing was, I'd said Audrey Richards, great friend of the governor, meeting people all the time, being asked, you know, couldn't you and the Institute do something on this? And the Labour Commissioner was one of these who said, we want to have a survey done of Kampala, where all the urban problems will be developing. So Audrey comes to me and says, wouldn't you like to do a social survey of Kampala? And I forget exactly what stage I was at, but we agreed that I ought to go and get what rapid lightning grounding in sociology, yes, was possible. So I think a UNESCO scholarship turned up at that moment. And actually, Audrey was away and had left me in charge of the Institute. So it was tricky, but I with this fellowship, I arranged to go and visit some of the obvious people in the US. And when Audrey came back, she was very angry because I'd had to give over to somebody else instead of maintaining my responsibility to her. So I went and I spent, well, the most famous person I spent time with, I suppose, was Talcott Parsons.
Yes, I could see the influence of his work in your work.
But there were many others.
What was he like?
Well, he was very gracious. He said, well, come to my seminar. Most people couldn't take it, but it was rather strong stuff because the small group who gathered round, they were, you know, tended to be developing a kind of secret language of their own. So you had to cope with all that if you joined in. But it was very, very stimulating. I mean, it gave me a sense of what there is there at a level where you can begin to size up what is worth what. And I went around to a number of other famous people, Lloyd Warner and people, to get a quick view of different aspects of sociology. And then I went back to the Institute, and I, by this time, was committed to doing this survey of Kampala, which was an impossible thing to do, really, because Kampala is so complex, ever-changing. At least, you know, need a huge team, and teams never worked. But I had an assistant appointed to the Institute who came out and told everybody that I was his assistant. That was Peter Gutkind.
Really? Oh, mm. Yes.
He has now left us, alas. Mm. So I think that when my 3Ds joke, I think it does leave the fact that I feel there is no other kind of initiation to social anthropology as it has been, or even as one can imagine it being, other than fieldwork, or a very major component of fieldwork.
Did you feel that the Kampala work was fieldwork based or anthropological, or did you just feel it was a sociological survey?
Oh, well, I just felt that it was sociology, and everybody knew that it was sociology for them. And I also knew that I could temper Parsonian theory to use in an anthropologically informed sociological survey, which is what I tried to do, but I'm afraid it was rather an unfinished symphony. But of course there were a lot of publications, but the best known of them, this assistant of mine who came out and spread the news that I was his assistant, we did this book about one of the slum areas, two neighbouring slum areas on the outskirts of Kampala, because Kampala is largely rural, really. There was only a very small zone that was getting quite dense and beginning to show the phenomena of slum life. So we wrote up a report on these two areas, and there was a very nice administrator in the Uganda service, an educated scholarly chap who was very interested and was always discussing the problems with us. And when we began thinking, what on earth will we call this thing, he produced a brilliant title, Townsmen in the Making. And Audrey had already got going a series called, of course, East African Studies. So there was that ready for it to go into. And so Peter Gookind and I did this very quickly and got it out by local printers. And it was a great success in, you know, selling far more than any other publication was, because it was a popularizer, very quickly produced and very cheap. I think we're selling it for 3 shillings or something like that in those days. And the joke was that the people who had most to do with Kampala crime, obviously, were likely to be police and police who were interested in that sort of thing. So Townsend in the making became known as a popular bedside book for police.
And criminals, probably, too.
Yes.
I was just going to... My former DPhil examiner.
Yes. And most prominent scholar on the ethnic group to which I devoted myself. Nilotic.
Hmm. What were your relations with him and what did you feel about his work?
Well, my relations with him were surely somewhat delicate in their development, but of course I knew Audrey very well, and she, though an utter contrast to E.P., was probably very fond of him, and he of her. So it was a recognizable tangle. But yes, I entered in a most unfortunate way, because I entered as an apparent rival, an apparent whippersnapper rival, because I picked a Nilotic people. I then began to write about them. And no, it was worse than that, actually, because I picked a people whom E.P. thought that he also had studied. And so when I began doing, luckily Audrey knew about all these things from the inside and warned me, you know, that it might be tricky because EP's thing had still not come out.
Which was that, the newer, or?
No.
One of the later Azandi ones?
No, it was an essay, an Nilotic essay, which did say a great deal about the Luo, but E.P. was always sufficiently controversial that he left openings for you to join in. But when I began, I mean, first it was happening to be in, E.P., first time, his first approach to me was, why don't you join us, you and I and Godfrey will be a Nilotic trio. Of course, that was hypocrisy or double dealing or what. But harmless. So anyway, I mean, he invited me to come to Oxford for a day, which I did. And I think I must have been taken to lunch in All Souls. And having done our time in the King's Arms beforehand, and that was repeated several times, but not frequently.
Did you like him? Did you admire him?
I admired him, certainly, yes. And I didn't know that I was ever with him enough on relaxed social terms to get to know whether I liked him or not.
What about Maya Fortes? Did you get to know him at all?
Well, not as much as I should have, but yes, towards the end, when he was in Cambridge and I was in Cambridge, sometimes or quite frequently.
Did you admire his work?
Well, I mean, you could. They were all one thing. Mm. Yes. And this business of writing on kinship and then getting more theoretical is a sort of pattern that seemed to be inescapable.
I was going to ask you about your recently, well, not too recently, but a little while ago, you wrote a very broad general overview of cities and civilizations, which has a framework which is almost identical to Marx's framework of the modes of production.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And you mentioned earlier in our conversation that you lectured on Marx in America.
Yes.
Did Marx or Weber or any of the other great sociological ancestors have a great influence on your work?
Well, yes, I think I've explained why. I mean, obviously, Talker Parsons had a great influence when I was trying to learn how one would learn to be a sociologist if one wished to do so. And then
through him, you were influenced by Weber, Max Weber, presumably.
Yes. But there was the other chap who came here.
Sociologist. Yes, I'll remember his name. I know who you mean. Parsons and...
Shills, yes, Shills. It was Shills. Right.
Yeah. You knew him?
Yes.
Would you say you were returning to Marx? A number of people I've talked to were deeply influenced by Marxist interpretations at one point in their life anyway. Were you?
Yes, there are times there was a certain sense in which, but I'm extremely rusty on it now, a sense in which Marx was inescapable. And I think still is. There was a woman who wrote a rather good book, I thought. Can't remember her name.
About Marx?
Well, it bore on the problem, bore on the question, yes.
One of the, in your cities book, one of the, and in an article, you wrote about Chinese cities. You haven't ever been to China.
I hadn't then, I have now, but it's not particularly relevant.
Hmm. What interested you about Chinese cities?
Not quite the oldest, but the greatest in many senses. And their long history made them, I thought, inescapable. And I looked at the sociology books and nobody mentioned them.
Did you look at the Japanese cities as well? Because they're very ancient and
well,
influenced.
Yes, I did. And I went to Japan and talked to some of them as well. And I tried to say something on Japan in that context in my book also.
Yes. Because you're unusual in a way as an anthropologist in that you studied rural peoples, you studied town and city peoples, and you also done quite a lot of global comparison and global history.
Yes.
Which of it do you think is your most... do you attach most importance to in your life?
Well, one thing led to another, so it's all my life. My book on cities, I knew was an interloper, and I knew it wouldn't be kindly received, but I really don't know how it was received, because people never seem to review books nowadays, or not much.
Mm. Well, there are some reviews on the web, as I mentioned. We might have a look and see if there's anything interesting in a minute.
Yes.
The last question I really had was about Africa, which is very much on all our minds at the moment with the G8 summit and discussions.
Yes.
I remember discussing with many times with Jack Goody, who you must also have known, about whether there was something special about sub-Saharan Africa which was making it particularly difficult for that area to develop economically and in other ways. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Not original, I don't think, but they were made underdogs for a long time until it affected them very fundamentally.
Mm. So colonialism.
Mm.
And what are your feelings about the future for Africa? Are you at either extreme of hope or despair, or are you in the middle of not sure?
Well, I have to put it in a world context which appears as though it is going to self-destruct. So it makes the perspective of very dubious length. And in that context, and I mean, in one sense, it doesn't matter much.
You mean the world is going to self-destruct? Or?
Yes.
Hmm. Through global warming, or...?
Yes. I mean, I have no expert knowledge of it, but I certainly believe it's more serious than Bush does.
I think Bush thinks it's more serious than Bush does too.